In the commotion of Rhiannon Martin's death, she'd hastily shoved it through one of the galvanized fans at the end of the turkey barn. Later, after they'd all been briefed and the area was cleaned up, she snuck it back into the rental car. It was not the first secret she'd kept from the moderators, but it was certainly the most dramatic. The sword was nearly as tall as she was, and wondrously and impossibly made. It felt like an extension of her arm, no more or less heavy than her own hand. The hilt was stunning, smooth silvery metal engraved with the words, "From Chaos." And when one was gripping it, one felt the words even when they weren't visible. The blade was made of the night sky, a sentence absurd to say out loud, but even more absurd to process. It did not look like a sword-shaped window into the night sky. It did not look like a blade painted to look like the night sky. It was the night sky. That was all there was to it. When she swung it, and she did an embarrassing number of times to Liliana's amusement, taking it out in the living rooms and hotel rooms and in the backyards of places where they stayed, it trailed starlight and moonlight, comets sparking, and universe dust shimmering. It could slice through just about anything. But slice wasn't exactly the right word either. The blade won. It won like the night won, like the darkness won. It simply descended. Farouk Lane suspected there was only one other weapon that would stop it, the sun blade last seen strapped to Ronan Lynch's back. "It suits you," Liliana said with an amused smile when Farouk Lane took it out at the latest short-term rental cottage. The blade cast jabbering, checkered patterns of light through the dormant, jasmine-covered pergola they stood under. It was a little chilly to sit outside, but Liliana did anyway, to be close to Farouk Lane, tucked into a faded wicker chair, knitting and bobbing one of her feet in a good-humored way. She was in her middle age now, the prime of her life. Her hair shone at this age, the many-sided tone that was red hair, in its own way impossible as a dream thing. As always, she'd tamed it with an ever-present blue fabric band, but the knot at the base of her pale neck was coming loose. The skin there always seemed as if it would be very soft. Farouk Lane swung From Chaos again, studying it, trying to understand both the sword and her fascination. A weapon can't suit someone, but it sort of did, and she wasn't sure how she felt about that. It was a dream, and she'd been working very hard to kill those for months. Farouk Lane used the sword to write Carmen in the dark. This really was a very nice cottage they were staying in at the moment. A sweet little bungalow with this pergola and a koi pond and vegetable garden behind it. All of the cottages were nice. They had to be. That was Liliana's requirement to work for the moderators. She had to be put up in places that felt like homes, and she had to be put up in them with Farouk Lane. A simple transaction. Stability for her present in exchange for visions of their future. Farouk Lane's relationship with the moderators was supposed to be as equally simple. In exchange for her services as a moderator, she received a sense of purpose. And it was simple, she told herself. Once one found out that the world was in danger, who could walk away from that? "They never found any of my brother's weapons," Farouk Lane said. She hadn't realized she was going to say it out loud until she did, and then she almost immediately wished she hadn't. She hoped Liliana hadn't heard, but Liliana stopped knitting. "Do you really want to talk about this?" Liliana asked. "No," Farouk Lane said, then the sword dipping a little in her hand. "It's all right." "That sword's deadly, and you were afraid of how you like it." Liliana knew her well at every age. Farouk Lane said, "You didn't see her face, Jordan Hennessy's. She wasn't bringing out a weapon on purpose. Whatever that thing was that I cut, this sword seemed made to destroy it. That's the opposite of intentionally destroying the world." Liliana began to knit again, jiggling her foot once more. You aren't going to say anything? Farouk Lane asked. You already said it, Liliana replied in her gentle way. Farouk Lane swung the sword again. Accidentally ending the world is still ending the world, though. Liliana held the knitting out from her body. It was turning into a sock or a scarf or something long. So they have to be stopped no matter what, Farouk Lane said. Well, controlled. We already know the apocalypse has to be generated by these Zeds. There's no other explanation for why they keep showing up in your visions, even if we can't tell what they're doing. The Potomac Zeds' acts of industrial espionage were getting bigger and bigger, although the moderators had had as much luck intercepting them at this as with anything else. It was difficult to divine the purpose, but there undoubtedly was one. Even in light of this, though, Locke had recently announced they were going to return to their previous method of taking out other Zeds. The Potomac Zeds couldn't blow up transistors and protect other Zeds, he reasoned. By taking up their old methods, the moderators could stop one or the other instead of just twiddling their thumbs. Back to business as usual, he said, as soon as the location intel was processed on the next vision. Business as usual. I'm going to quit, Farouk Lane said suddenly. She put the sword back in its scabbard, instantly reducing the light of the chilly backyard to just the subtle dazzle of the twinkle lights strung through the pergola. I'm going to quit the moderators. Liliana's knitting needles clicked faintly as she did another row. Farouk Lane's heart was thudding in her ears and her hands felt ice cold. Aren't you going to say anything? It had been a little over a year since Nathan had killed their parents, since she had found out her brother was a serial killer, since she found out he was a Zed, since she found out the end of the world was coming, since she had helped kill Zed after Zed while the fire got closer and closer. She'd lost most of her life with the murders and given the rest of it away to join the moderators. Without them, she'd have to devise an entirely new future for herself, whole cloth. Liliana, Farouk Lane said, anything at all? Neatly folding her scarf sock thing and setting it on the chair, Liliana stood. She walked to Farouk Lane, took the scabbard from her hand, and leaned it against the pergola support. The twinkle lights made a galaxy of night stars in her eyes as she stepped close. Then she gently brushed Farouk Lane's hair with the palm of her hand, and she kissed her. Farouk Lane closed her eyes. She put her hands where the knot of the blue fabric was coming loose. The skin there was very soft. When the kiss was done, Liliana said, "What are you going to do instead? I will come with you, of course." It was going to be so difficult to do this alone, to take from the moderators the one supernatural tool they had in their arsenal. Liliana. To leave them blind, to trust herself instead. But Farouk Lane's voice didn't waver as she replied, "Save the world." 21. A boat ride. Jordan, suppose she could do a boat ride, although she had to admit she was disappointed. It was very civilized, very pretty. They'd gotten to Boston Harbor an hour or so before dark as the sky glowed orange behind the Boston skyline of skyscrapers and clock towers. The icy water lapped darkly against tour boats drowsing at the wharf. The sailboats that were still out this late in the year lay gracefully on the water, their plumage lowered and only bones remaining. As habit, Jordan thought about how she would paint her surroundings, which brush she would use to draw those fine, fine hairs of rigging etched delicately against the sky. But it was a bit of a dull exercise. It was too obvious a scene, chosen by too many artists and photographers over the years, because it was pretty. Pretty was good, she told herself. Nice was good. Just a little disappointing. Matthew, actually buckle that life vest. Actually, buckle it, Declan said. You look quite at home here on the water, quite at home here in Boston altogether. A handsome Irish-American fellow with a head of tamed curls and those narrow, squinted eyes of a Celt. Collared shirt, nice sweater, good jacket, all of a piece with the pretty skyline and the boat and the water. Hennessy would hate him so much, Jordan thought. Congratulations, she'd say. You've found boring white man number 314. A date in Boston Harbor would only underline Hennessy's point, because it was nice, because it was pretty, because you could read about it on the tourism site and purchase tickets, because it was a thing everyone might like. How romantic, Hennessy's voice would drip with judgment. Jordan had to make do with imagining Hennessy's voice since she hadn't called. Why hadn't she called? Jordan knew she was alive and well because Ronan had called Declan. Well, and because Jordan was still standing. Silence from Hennessy was as worrisome as words. How do you know I wasn't made to float? Matthew was saying petulantly. Mother Mary, Declan said with exasperation, do we have to do this every day? Just say you want a therapist for your birthday. Do you still call it a birthday if it's the day you just, like, appeared? Matthew asked. Jordan contemplated inserting herself into this discussion, but decided it was more about brothers than it was about the dreaming. She knew more about one of these things than the other. Everyone just appears at some point, Matthew, Declan said, removing the last of the lines, securing them to the pier. Jordan, are you tied down? She saluted him. They were off. The engine drowned out the protests of the seagulls overhead and the voices of pedestrians on the wharf they left behind. The water chopped up white and gray and black behind them. The Atlantic Ocean hissed cold winter wind from the darkening horizon. It wasn't entirely civilized, Jordan supposed, because the temperature was too wild, and Declan drove the boat a little too fast across the waves for romantic sightseeing. Why did Jordan care what Hennessy would think anyway? She didn't, actually. She just missed her. While Matthew huddled on the back of the boat with a bag of potato chips, Jordan eventually got tired of the chill and joined Declan at the wheel behind the relative protection of the windshield. Where did you learn to drive a boat? Jordan asked, voice raised to be heard. It would be easier to talk if he cut the engine, but he seemed intent on a destination, clipping past various wharfs and frequently glancing over his shoulder to get his bearings. Your father? Declan laughed. A senator I worked for taught me. He said it was a life skill. Zombie apocalypse. Fundraising opportunities. Same difference. Declan smiled thinly at the ocean. It's that catch-22 of money. People feel better about donating money to people who already have it. Did you find anything out today? For weeks, Jordan had been throwing herself against the question of sweet metals. She returned to El Jaleo again and again, trying to understand the rules of it. How far its influence extended, if it varied from day to day. How it did what it did. It wasn't the only sergeant she visited, either. She tracked down as many sergeants as she could to see if any of them were sweet metals, too. It wasn't difficult to find a sergeant in Boston. This had been his city when he was in the States. He'd painted the murals on the ceilings of the MFA and the walls of the public library. Harvard's Fogg Museum and the Massachusetts Historical Society had portraits of movers and shakers. The Peabody Essex, the Addison, and the Worcester had more portraits, many watercolors, many, many sketches. She saw pieces she'd copied before, like his splendid and somewhat eerie Daughters of Edward Darley Boyd at the MFA, and so many others her fingers itched to copy, like a facile watercolor of alligators at the Worcester. She saw dozens upon dozens of his works. Several of them gave her the general feeling of a sweet metal, but only three felt strong enough to actually be useful to a dream in need of energy. El Jaleo, Boyd's daughters, and an only recently discovered painting, a dramatic nude of Thomas McKellar, the black man Sargent used as his primary model for his MFA murals. The latter had been hidden away in Sargent's private collection for years, and his real relationship to the man in the painting remained so. She was no closer to understanding how sweet metals worked, and if anyone knew anything about them, they weren't talking to her. "Several of the Monets are sweet metals," Jordan said, "at the MFA. "Water lilies?" Declan suggested. "One of the cathedrals, if you can believe it. The lilies gave me nothing at all." Her first theory had been that a piece's sweet metal value was linked to its artistic merit, but she'd had to abandon it for lack of evidence. Several of the pieces that felt the strongest to Jordan at the Boudicca demonstration were the least artistically accomplished, after all. And there were many masterpieces that left her cold in the sweet metal department. Her next theory? She had no next theory. She decided her next step was to do a deep dive into the backgrounds of each of the sweet metals she found to see if there were clues there. But then Declan had invited her on this boat ride. Boat ride. It was a fine distraction, she told herself. She shouldn't let herself feel hurried by Boudicca's timeline, by Hennessy's silence.
"Have you thought about stealing one?" Declan asked casually.
Not from the gardener, but from somewhere.
"Of course."
"Which?"
"Easiest would be nicking one like Sherry Lamb's, but it hardly seems worth the crime, does it? It's not got a lot of oomph to it. If I stole one, I'd go big."
He leaned the wheel to the left, sending them deeper into the harbor.
"Tell me how you'd do it. Blue sky thinking."
Jordan ducked under his arm on the wheel in order to sit on his lap. He matter-of-factly sorted out her voluminous ponytail as she leaned her head back on his chest to gaze up at the shifting evening sky. He bent his head prayerfully, eyes still on their destination. Now mouths and ears were close enough for speaking at regular volume in this fast-moving boat. "The provenance game always makes the most sense to me." Provenance was the real work of a forger, the show your work of the art world. Beauty was nothing without bloodline. Creating the art in the style of a master was only the first step. Then came paperwork and research. Fastidious work that began and ended with a story. A forged piece couldn't just spring into being. No one would believe one had suddenly found a new Monet, a new Cassatt, a new whatever it was. An alibi had to be invented, proven, knit into truth. Where had it been all these years? The more desirable the work, the better the story had to be. Hidden in a recluse's private collection? Misattributed for years by bumpkins, discovered in a hidden basement after a house fire. But one could not just invent reclusive collectors or uncertain bumpkins or hidden basements. The forger had to find ones that already existed and slide the story in, making as small an incision in the truth as possible in order to promote unscarred healing to the timeline. Sometimes, depending on the buyer, this was as simple as including a news clipping of a recent manor house fire. For good museums or discerning buyers, bills of sale or insurance claims for stolen works or letters from contemporaries mentioning the work or photographs of the work next to relatives of the artist sometimes needed to be forged. Provenance. The crux of it, the crux of the plan, Jordan said, would be convincing the museum what they already had on their wall was a forgery, had been a forgery all along. Probably I'd get a slick young fellow with good teeth to convince them the original was swapped at some prior time, ideally before their tenure, so no hard feelings. I'd pick a year before it had got the hardest scientific evidence, the most scrutiny, all that noodly stuff that would make it tricky to forge. Before it was x-rayed. Lead soap damage analysis, all that. I'd convince them all the things they'd been studying and writing up in their academic papers were actually attributes of the forgery, that the original has entirely different layers and damage.
Declan had followed along beautifully. He said, "You'd need a whipping boy."
"Of course." She was always surprised by how well he knew the sideways world. He just didn't seem to fit the part. She supposed that had been the point of his camouflage all along. Look like a man who takes his dates to cheesy tourist attractions. Be a man who steals paintings. You'd have to place the blame for the first theft on someone who is currently there or stands to suffer from it.
"Then you'd sweep in with your original," Declan said, "and tell them you're willing to secretly swap it for the forgery on display and let their negligence stay secret too if they help you."
"You've got it. The Dark Lady play." He didn't sound sore that the theft of his mother's portrait had been what brought them together in the first place.
"But you don't want to do that."
"I don't understand how to live that way," Jordan said. "I can't carry around, like, a famous painting while I go about my day in order. I'd be trapped in the same room as it. A painting. A whole painting. Could I cut it into little pieces?"
She felt Declan's body recoil at the prospect.
"There'd be no way to find out until you ruined the thing you just worked very hard to steal. And could I live with knowing I'd chopped up a sergeant? Not bloody likely." She shifted her head on his chest. He tilted his chin. She felt his breath suck in.
"The very concept gives me indigestion," Declan said. Then he twitched his shoulder to tell her to move. "I need to steer us in. We're there. Tie us off, can you?"
To her surprise, they were not at a scenic point or romantic destination. They were at a private pier attached to a development of very choice row houses jutting directly out onto the harbor.
"Matthew, the painting," Declan said. "Please don't drop it in the water."
"What's all this?" Jordan asked as Matthew trundled gingerly up toward them with a parcel and very familiar wrapping. "The Dark Lady. The dreamt portrait of Declan's birth mother, Morakora, invested with the magical property of making whoever slept under the same roof as a dream of the sea. The dreamt portrait Jordan had once forged and once stolen and once returned." Declan held out a hand to help her step from the rocking boat onto the pier.
"I told you I was going to show you a good time, didn't I?"
Three exceptionally blonde people had emerged from one of the houses, a man, a woman, and a teenager, all of them dressed for the weather, each carrying or dragging a piece of luggage. They started down the pier toward a boat rather larger than the one Declan, Jordan, and Matthew had arrived in, but when the man caught sight of Declan, he stopped.
"All right, Cody," the man told the teen, voice raised as he rummaged out a set of keys and dangled them. "Take that painting from him and put it just inside, would you? By the other things to go out. Lock the door after you. Lock it. Check it this time, please."
The teen sulked up to Declan, took the painting of Declan's mother, and jogged it back to the house as the couple joined Declan, Jordan, and Matthew. "I'm going to go get the stuff situated," said the woman, smiling politely but continuing down the pier.
"Be there in a minute," the man said.
He and Declan shook hands casually, lightly, and then politely he shook with Jordan as well. He offered a hand to Matthew, too, but Matthew had turned at just that moment to crouch and look over the edge at the water.
"Sorry for the short notice," the man continued.
"There was no problem," Declan said. "Good way to escape the traffic."
"It seems silly to me this can't be done over email or phone, but this is tradition, and I'm not going to be the first to break it. You know what I mean?" the man said. "What do you want to know?"
Instead of answering, Declan said, "Jordan, Miggle was on the MFA board for 15 years.
15 years, Declan agreed. "He has dealt with several sweet metals."
Jordan looked at Declan instead of at Miggle. A boat ride. A fine, pretty boat ride.
"There's quite a bit of legend around them," Miggle went on. "I don't want to say a secret society because that makes it seem organized, and it really isn't.
It is more that anyone who deals in much art quickly learns to tell what is good art
and what isn't. What is going to make a splash, what isn't. You get that sense in your head for what is worth your time. And it is not hard to tell after a while of dealing with art, high-end art, that some of them are these sweet metals. They are special, you know. People like them. They have that something. They sell for much more than you would think because of that something. So it pays to keep your eye out for it. But they are an open secret. You don't really talk about them. You wouldn't advertise something as a sweet metal. It's, what's the word? Gauche. The mystery is part of what makes them what they are. There's just a tradition of not putting anything about them in writing, if you can help it. And if you do, burn it. It's all very Ouija board. What do you want to know? Declan held his hand out to Jordan, the universal gesture for after you. How are they made? Jordan asked. How is it put into them? Do you know? Miggle squinted as if the question wasn't exactly logical to him, but then he answered slowly. Oh, I see what you are saying. The artist does it. It is something about how they are feeling when they make the art. I thought when I first saw one that it was because the art was special to the world in some way. A real original, you know. But it was explained to me later, and this makes more sense. They are special to the artist in some way. They are an original for the artist, something new for them, something personal for them. The subject matter, sometimes, how they felt when they were painting it, others. This is what seems to make some of them into sweet metals. I do not think it is the artist who does it. It is like the spirit of the time. There is a French term for that, isn't there? There is a French term for everything. Does that answer the question? Declan looked to Jordan to see if it did. And you don't know what this is, what the specific bit is about the artist's process that does it, she said. You don't know anything more specific about this spirit of the time. All I know is that artists who produce sweet metals don't always make sweet metals, he said. They can make two in a row, maybe, and then none for the rest of time. Now, most of them are in private hands. But you know there are a few in the city, right? Open to the public? El Haleo, Declan said. Yes, Miguel said. Sargent was good at them, but I suppose he was very prolific too, wasn't he? Have you ever seen his Madame X? Of course she had. Of course. Madame X was Sargent's self-proclaimed masterpiece with all its checkered history. It was one of the first Sargents Jordan had ever tried to copy. She and Hennessy had taken turns at it, sometimes even working on the same copy as they did it over and over again. There was a full-length copy of it back in the McLean mansion with a bunch of bullet holes in its head, just like the poor girls who might still be there too. Miggle saw from their expressions they had. It's a sweet metal too, off the charts. Whatever those two have in common, that's what makes a sweet metal. His teen son jogged up to give Miggle his house keys. He'd locked away the portrait of Declan's mother safely inside the house. Thank you for making the time before your trip, Declan said. Thank you for facilitating, Miggle replied. I'm sure we'll be in touch again. That text number is good for you, right? Handshakes were exchanged again. More murmured pleasantries, and then finally Declan, Jordan, and Matthew were left standing on the pier. The wind whipped at them. The masts behind them were skeletons. The pretty evening was turning into something even more feral. It's kind of weird that water shows you your own face, Matthew said, but in an absent way. Jordan said, that was the painting of your mother. Yes, Declan said. It still is. I just don't have it anymore. You traded it for this information? Yes. They studied each other.
He looked less ordinary as the sun disappeared and deepened the shadows beneath his eyebrows, obscuring the shape of his eyes, his expression. "This was a good time, Patsy," she told him. Declan turned his face into the wind so that the darkness would hide his smile from her. He said, "I expect great things from my portrait." 22. Hennessy knew that everyone had secrets. Secrets were what made you who you were. Once, Hennessy had read a book on drawing that said the key to getting a good likeness was getting the shadows right. It wasn't by the positive forms that one was recognized. We know people's faces by their shadows. Hennessy thought secrets were like that. Each of her girls started life as Hennessy, thinking like her, acting like her, but eventually something happened, and they got a secret, and that was when they became their own person. It was possible Hennessy believed people simply were their secrets. J.H. Hennessy's secret was that she could only love one person at a time. It might appear as if she loved other people, like her daughter, or other activities like painting, but she really only loved Bill Dower. Everything went well for painting and for Hennessy as long as everything was going well with Bill Dower. But if it wasn't, anything could be sacrificed in the service of preserving that love. Daughter, career, friends, house. These were just well-treated pawns in a board game with only two players. Jordan's secret was that she wanted to live apart from Hennessy. She might have denied this to save Hennessy's feelings, but Hennessy had followed her. She'd seen the apartments Jordan daydreamed about. She'd looked through Jordan's phone as she slept and seen the zip codes she fantasized over. She knew the galleries Jordan ogled. She knew the schools Jordan pictured herself attending. No matter how exciting Hennessy made their lives, no matter how many high-end jobs she had them take, how many low-brow parties she had them attend, how big she made their shared life, Jordan still wanted her own. No one wanted to live with Hennessy forever, not even Hennessy. Hennessy's secret was that she didn't want the ley line to get any more powerful. When one engages in havoc all the time, Hennessy said, it becomes a kind of un-havoc. The three dreamers were in an older neighborhood. Hennessy had long since lost sense of where. City and state were all negotiable. The light was peculiar and yellow-green. It was the end of the day, which ordinarily made ugly places more paintable. But tonight, the clouds were hanging low and wrong over this town, raggedly caught on telephone wires, and the last of the dying sun came in sideways and murky. Snow was drifting down here and there as if the clouds were sloughing. The streets were muddy with fallen and melted snow and sand. It was ugly, unpaintably ugly. Hennessy went on. The very act of disruption, instead, becomes the opposite. Ruption, the act of maintaining the status quo, because the status quo has now become chaos. Now, if one wants to prove themselves a game changer, they instead must restore order. What a mind fuck.
Are you saying that you need a break after this?
Bride interrupted.
I was making some psychological observations as conversation to fill the time.
What do you feel? Bride asked.
Ronan let out a noisy breath as he drummed his fingers against the window. He had been getting more and more restless these past few days, knees jiggling, fingers drumming, pacing, jumping on top of shit, jumping off of shit. He dreamt when they needed to dream. Otherwise, he didn't sleep at all. Hennessy thought this game of dominoes was changing him, or perhaps revealing him. "It's fucking weird," he said. It was hard to feel the true strength of the ley line here because there were so many things Hennessy now knew obscured it. Low, unshielded telephone lines, standing oily water puddled in pitted asphalt, houses crowded on top of each other with wires trailing from them like guts. Satellite dishes sprouted like dark mushrooms from some of the roofs. There was something else, though, that made it truly ugly, and Hennessy couldn't quite figure out what it was. Maybe it was just her mood.
"Hennessy," Bright said sharply, turning from the passenger seat to look at her in the back. "What do you feel?"
"What Ronan Lynch said," Hennessy replied. "Something's janky."
Bride said, "This will be a difficult one. Three large buildings will need to be leveled. I don't know how well we will be able to dream when we are at the site, so we may need to use things we already have. We will need to stay focused. I may need you to do this one on your own. I don't know yet."
Ronan caught Hennessy's eye in the rearview mirror. His thick eyebrows went up. This was unusual. She shrugged.
"In fact," Bride said, "I need one of you to drive us there, just in case."
Need one of you to drive. Bride didn't need them for anything. They needed him. But this evening, Bride pulled Burrito into an uneven parking lot in front of a closed lumber yard. As Ronan and Hennessy briefly scuffled over who would drive in his place, Hennessy won. Ronan was distracted keeping Chainsaw inside the car. Bride climbed into the back seat. After the door shut behind him, Ronan hissed, "What's going on here?"
"Do I look like his minder?" Hennessy replied. "You ask him."
They got back in. They did not ask him. No one said anything as they drove through the ugly town and through a few minutes of patchily occupied countryside. The rutted road suddenly ended at a dark, freshly paved entrance to a corporate facility of some kind. A very clean white sign read simply, "Digital Solutions." Hennessy glanced into the rearview mirror at Bride. In the green-yellow light, she saw only that he was sitting perfectly still as he looked out the window, his eyes squinted as if against sun. Digital Solutions turned out to be a complex of three unassuming but enormous white buildings in the middle of a well-tended parking lot. In every way, it seemed less ugly than the town they'd left behind. Neatly mowed grass that seemed too green for this time of year. Black, black asphalt that was level as glass. Clean white sides on the buildings, each printed with the same ambiguous words, "Digital Solutions." Hennessy took the opportunity of the empty parking lot to do a few donuts in Burrito, hoping to make her ugly mood dizzy enough to fall down and not get back up again. But eventually she had to stop. Her ears were ringing. She yawned to clear them, then yawned again. They kept ringing. It was a little like when you'd hit your head and you were struggling against vertigo. It was also a little like when you'd left the television on but turned the sound down. It was also a little like a refrigerator. She yanked up the parking brake. The snow floated like ash in front of the windshield and melted on the fake-looking grass. Her ears continued to ring. "What's that sound?" Ronan said. "Fuck if I know. I thought it was me." The sound continued. It was a strange sound, a yellow-green sound that matched the yellow-green afternoon. There were no cars in the lot, no people, no signs of life. Just the ragged clouds and the sickly color bleeding at the horizon. Those clumpy snowflakes that melted straight to grime. Outside the car, the sound was even louder. It was the unending, unchanging nature of it that was the most harrowing, she thought. It never varied, so it became part of you. Pressing in, pressing out from the air, from the ground, from the buildings. Ronan's raven flapped into the air briefly before returning to the asphalt to stand stupidly, shaking her head like something clung to it. Ronan joined Hennessy and they stood shoulder to shoulder, eyeing the buildings, the parking lot lights, the identical buildings with their identical lobby entrances made of black glass, all simple as a child's drawing. The sound continued to come from everywhere. It seemed obvious there was nothing living here. One could not ask for a more complete opposite to the silent, vital forest around Illidorin. "What powers the world, bro?" Hennessy said, suddenly understanding what she was looking at. "Zeros and ones. Memes and giggles. Forums and Fortnite, right? It's a, what do you call it? Data farm. Server farm. A what? I'll bet you my fine ass that inside those buildings are banks and banks of servers," Hennessy said. "Facebook, Instabook, Twitterbook, TikTokbook, Tumblrbook. This is one of their hive minds. I could be wrong, but I don't think I am. I saw an art exhibit once about a guy who tried to sue a sound." "Servers make noise?" Ronan asked. He answered his own question. "Cooling fans." "That's it, Mr. Fix-It." "I can't dream here," Ronan said, matter of fact. "It would be a shit show of epic proportions. We have to take it down with what we already have. Too bad you gave your sword to the mods. Do we need to take down the whole building or just everything in it, Bride?" But Bride didn't reply. He hadn't joined them at the front of the car. They turned to look. The car's rear door hung open. Bride had made it out, but not by much. He was sort of crouched in the diffuse shadow of the open car door, sort of standing. His body was curved in a question mark. It quivered. His fingers were cages over his ears. He was screaming. Or at least, he looked like he was screaming. With his hands over his ears, he screamed and screamed again, but without sound. It was all the agony of a howl, without any of the noise, which somehow made it worse. It was like the sound of the server farm and the scream were a thing happening to Bride. It made him a different person, somehow less present, projected in from a different location. They did not need to be told that it was hurting him. "What do you hear?" Ronan seemed shaken too, but it was with a voice full of bravado that he turned his face away from Bride and said, "It's up to us then." "We can just go," Hennessy said. "Leave this untouched. Tell him we did it. Maybe he won't notice." Ronan gave her a look. "The car. Let's drive burritos through." "Through that glass and stuff? Is it tough enough for that?" "Please," Ronan gave her another look. "Are you coming or are you waiting here?" "Are we taking him?" They looked back at Bride. It was strange to see him still pinned in place. Was it possible for a sound to kill someone? Was it possible for something to kill Bride? "Older than he imagines," she remembered him saying. She told Ronan, "Go on, I'll watch, I'll give you a score. Perfect 10 is the car comes out without a scratch. 9 if you bust the mirror off. It goes down from there. 1 is if we have to walk through that town, which I have to say reminds me of Pennsylvania." "We're in Pennsylvania," Ronan said. "That settles it." Hennessy stood in the parking lot as Ronan drove the car away from them both, expertly spinning it to the left to slam the still-open back door shut. The car instantly became hard to see, even though she could hear the pounding bass of music from within it. It was not enough to drown out the complex's sound, which was still everywhere, inside her, inescapable, unrelenting. It required no human hands to do its work. It was in there powering that sound all by itself, working away at Bride without feeling or pause. Humans were so good at pollution. The best.
Suddenly, a massive hole appeared in the dark glass lobby doors of the closest building. Ronan had driven right in. For just a moment, Burrito was visible in the reflection of the remaining glass, and then it winked out of view. Crashing sounded from within the building. Minutes passed. Although it was impossible to see what was happening, it was nonetheless obvious that something was happening, because the terrible sound had gotten a little quieter, replaced now by security alarms. Bride had stopped screaming and instead was simply hunched, eyes closed in pain, hands still over ears. Hennessy missed the moment of Burrito emerging from the first building, but she saw the moment it crashed into the second. That shivering glass, that brief reflection. Again, as Ronan did his work inside the building, the terrible sound went down another notch, replaced by yet more ordinary howling of alarms. She wondered if they were hooked up to anything. She wondered if she'd need to bedazzle any security forces with one of Bride's silver orbs. She examined her conscience to see if she would be willing to rummage in Bride's jacket to retrieve one of the orbs while he stood there. Hennessy ordinarily had no problem violating people's personal space, but with Bride, it felt wrong. This, she thought, was probably related to Bride's secrets. By the time Ronan and Burrito crashed into the third building, Bride had lowered his hands from his ears and simply stood, staring dead-eyed and haggard off into the distance. Then the terrible sound was gone, and so were the alarms, so Ronan must have destroyed those too. There was only the sound of an unmanned business park several miles away from an ugly town. Distant trucks, far away heating and air conditioning units, tractors and birds. This time, the laser surge was so powerful that it nearly knocked Hennessy right off her feet. It was less that she was physically struck and more like the ground beneath her feet suddenly seemed unimportant. She was a part of a huge, ancient thing that was slowly stretching, slowly coming back to life. And she suddenly thought she understood in a very real way why the moderators were doing everything in their power to catch them. Bride looked nearly like himself as the sound of Burrito's engine drew near. The car was still hard to see, but Hennessy guessed that Ronan hadn't lost a mirror. Burrito was strong. Ronan was strong. Hennessy was strong. They were all very, very strong. And getting stronger all the time. The ley line was singing through her even louder than that server farm had, only it was worse. Because she knew this feeling meant she could manifest so, so much of the lace. Bride said in a low voice, "Have you guessed my secret, Hennessy?" Hennessy studied Bride. Again, she thought about how unusual a person he was. He was a little like the car, hard to look at, hard to see. Or maybe she was just thinking that now that she'd seen him screaming, it was hard to look at him the same way. She said, "Is this a game?" He closed his eyes. He was still hurting a little, she could tell. In a stiff voice, he said, "It's all a big game. We're pieces." Then he opened his eyes again. "You asked for a rest. We are nearly to the end." "I didn't ask for a break," Hennessy said. Her secret was this. She was tired of trying. 23. Madam X, Madam X, Madam X. When Declan slept, he dreamt of her. Virginie Amelie Avignon Gautreau, the red-haired beauty who powdered her face and pinked her ears to make herself unforgettable. A painting before she ever showed up on a canvas as John Singer Sargent's Madame X. Virginie Amelie Avignon Gautreau. Her face turned in striking profile, shoulders proud, fingers poised on the table. Virginie Amelie Avignon Gautreau.
With her suitable but troubled young marriage, her many affairs, the dress strap slid from her shoulder to subtly imply she lived two lives, a proper daylight existence and a stolen shadow existence that was a reaction to the unsuitability of the first, Madame X. When he woke up, he thought about the circumstances under which she had been painted. When Declan went to sleep, he thought about how she might be similar to El Jaleo. All the hours in between, he thought about how that process might be recreated to make a new sweet metal. Madame X, Madame X, Madame X. And by Madame X, he meant Jordan Hennessy. He couldn't get enough of her. Boston suited him. Schedule suited him. Appointments, phone calls, goals, they all suited him. Building an elaborate spider web, a proper one, structurally sound on the outermost corners and sticky only in the very middle so that it trapped only the insects he liked to eat and not himself in it, suited him. He was making a plan. It was high stakes and it was dangerous, and Jordan was right. He liked it. He liked all of it. Declan liked the alarm at 6 a.m., he liked the cafes that woke up even before he did. He liked the ding of the email that meant his newspaper had arrived in his inbox. He liked the squeak of his Charlie card in the turnstile. He liked the jostle and noise of the tea as he read the headlines and swiped to the business section. He liked hearing from a new business contact he'd gotten from one of his father's old contacts. He liked the assembly of jobs and tasks that got ever more complex as trust built. Declan liked being buried to his neck in art history. He had begun as Potsy, and Potsy was a good start. Potsy was how Madame X had begun, after all, with Sergeant asking his friend, Dr. Potsy, to introduce him to Virginie Amélie Avignon Gautreau as a portrait subject. Madame Gautreau. Sergeant found her an impossibly beautiful and hopelessly lazy model. He sketched her over and over, painted her over and over, trying to capture on canvas whatever it was that made her famous in social circles. And when he did, when he painted that haughty beauty with her strap impudently fallen on her marble shoulder, the scandal nearly ruined him. Some things weren't meant to be painted out loud. Sargent's friend, the novelist Henry James, persuaded him to move to Britain to get away from the disgrace, so Sergeant started his life from scratch there, not knowing that eventually Madame X was to be the painting he was best known for. Was that what Declan was doing here in Boston? Declan didn't know, but he liked it. Declan liked the parties, and there were ever so many parties. He had never allowed himself to be so public in D.C., so himself, so out and about, but Jordan argued that extroversion was actually safer. It took no effort, she noted, to disappear someone who didn't really exist, so they should live loudly. It was impeccable logic, and in any case, what Declan wanted to hear. He liked making his burner phone his real phone, making sure that, yes, it was a good number for him, a permanent number for him, a place to get the man for the job. The first get-together was small, an exhibit opening at a tiny Fenway gallery, drinks and music, a funky vibe, young collectors, an after-party that spilled into a bar. After that, Declan bumped into his senator's sister's daughter on the street in Somerville and got invited to dinner, which turned into drinks, which turned into dancing. All of it turned into more texts and calls and invitations. Jordan was an exceptional and practiced partygoer. He liked how he looked on her arm. Declan liked finding out how passionate Sargent had been about El Jaleo. A musician himself, Sargent had been fascinated by the culture of flamenco, and a trip to Spain had left such a mark that 3 years later he was still painting studies of dancers and guitarists for the piece that would eventually hang in the Gardner. When the 12-foot-long painting debuted at the prestigious Salon, it rocketed Sargent to fame and cemented a career that would last his entire life. Was this what it had in common with Madame X? Was it that the painting changed his life, or was it that he knew that it was going to change his life? What was soul? Declan didn't know, but he liked trying to find out.
Declan liked the new roles his brothers played in this fantastic construct. Even though he felt guilty about letting Matthew's schoolwork slide, was he going to college anyway? Would he ever actually be an adult? He liked ordering takeout with him, and he liked using him as an excuse to see the touristy things, and he liked doing the holidays with him. Matthew's dreamy episodes seemed to be fewer than before, and Declan felt safe enough to get Matthew a part-time job at one of the local galleries, packing orders, which seemed to improve his mood. Everyone loved seeing him. Who didn't love Matthew? And Ronan, even though he wasn't in Boston, his presence was still huge in Declan's life. Once Declan stopped changing his phone number and started going to parties, a moderator named Carmen Farouk Lane called to ask if he'd been in touch with Ronan Lynch since the Potomac River incident. No, said Declan, but while I have you on the phone, I should let you know I've made very good friends with an attorney since your unannounced attack on my personal residence. A sentence that ended the phone call. And in the oddest places, people would lean in and suddenly whisper, Are you Ronan Lynch's brother? Please thank him. This would have petrified Declan back in D.C., but now it all made him feel like he was part of something bigger. Golden Matthew, charming the city. Rebellious Ronan, finally grown into something useful. Cunning Declan, trafficking in art and stories. The brothers Lynch. He liked not worrying about them all the time. Declan liked coming to the Fenway Studios at the end of the day when Jordan was just waking up for her work day, which lasted all night. He liked that without any conversation, they decided it was right for him to sit in the antique leather chair by the window and tell her about his day while she worked at her canvases. He liked that she had begun painting him again, although she refused to show him this portrait. He liked that she was trying to make him her sweet metal. He liked watching her create her copies of El Jaleo and Madame X, her ability with the brush never failing to transfix him as she forged layer upon layer in oils, same as when he had first glimpsed her at the ferry market. Virginie, Amelie, Avignon, Gautreau, Jordan Hennessy. He thought about her all the time. He liked it all. He liked it very much.
What are you thinking? Matthew asked.
What?
What are you thinking about?
I'm not thinking about anything, Matthew. I'm just waiting for Jordan, like you are.
The two brothers lingered in the Dutch room in the Gardner Museum, killing time until Jordan was meant to meet them for late lunch. Breakfast for her, since she probably was only just now waking up.
You are thinking, though.
Matthew insisted. He had that whinge to his voice that indicated today was going to be one of his tricky days.
You're thinking of things you're going to talk about with Jordan. Why don't you talk about them with me?
He wasn't wrong, which was an impressive display of discernment on his part, but it was no less aggravating. Declan said, Because you're two different people. I'm not going to copy-paste a conversation.
You just think I'm stupider than her,
Matthew said.
You save all the smart things to talk about with her and then just point out people walking dogs to me.
Do you or don't you like it when I point out dogs? Declan asked. Matthew groused.
I don't only like when you point out dogs. I want to know what you're doing, what you're like, you know, thinking.
Fine, Declan said. I was wondering if these paintings are sweet metals, if that's why they were stolen. The green wallpapered Dutch room in the Gardner was notable for many things, including a Rembrandt self-portrait, a few Rubens, and some very excellent historical furniture, but it was now probably most famous for the things that weren't there. One cold March, several decades before, two thieves dressed as policemen had stolen 13 works, including a Rembrandt and a Vermeer. It remained the largest unsolved art heist in history. Any crime of that size would have been notable, but the loss was felt even more acutely because the Gardner Museum was both small and unusual.
unable to rebound in the way any other museum might have. Isabella Stewart Gardner had overseen every inch of the intimate museum's creation. She'd acquired and placed every piece, micromanaged down to the building and tearing down of walls and other architectural features, and one of the requirements in her will was that nothing in the museum be changed after her death. Even widening one of the doorways a few inches for accessibility had required petitions and paperwork. This mandate meant that the museum couldn't acquire new works or rearrange old ones to take the place of the stolen works. Instead, the empty frames had been hung back up where the pieces had been. In essence, the loss itself was now displayed. And what more universal piece of art could there be? Sweet metals, why? Because they were weird choices? The stolen stuff, I mean? Matthew asked, which again displayed slightly more focus than Declan had come to expect from his brother. He'd been paying attention on their many visits. Because they were weird, yes. Because there were more expensive pieces hanging just feet away, and they left them. Because they took that bronze finial, of all things. The bird thing, said Matthew. Yes, Declan echoed dryly. This was more of what he expected from his brother. The bird thing. For decades, experts had been trying to understand why the thieves had taken the pieces they had and why they had treated them the way they did. They'd hacked valuable canvases right out of the frame. They'd pocketed disparate works on paper. They'd taken the Shang Dynasty bronze beaker that had been on the table in front of the Rembrandt they also stole. And of course, as Matthew noted, the bird thing. They had stolen a bronze eagle finial off the end of a random flagpole. Was it personal? Experts wondered. A random grab? What did these works have in common? I was thinking if they were sweet metals, the randomness would make sense, Declan said. Or at least as much sense as any other explanation. It wouldn't have been about traditional value or artistic merit, just energy. But why didn't they take the dancing lady, then? El Jaleo. That's what I said, dancing lady with her arm on backward. Declan resented the somewhat accurate description of the painting, but let it pass. I don't know. Maybe they ran out of time. Maybe it was too big. Maybe they had been told not to.
By who?
Powerful people are interested in these things, Declan said. Powerful people control a lot of them. It's why we're working very carefully.
Wouldn't that mean if Jordan made one, she'd be powerful people? Matthew asked.
Declan looked sharply at his brother. Yes, I guess it does. But what he didn't say out loud was that unguarded power was actually weakness. If you had something someone else wanted and no way to stop them from taking it, you were vulnerable to exploitation. Jordan and her sweet metal. Ronan and his dreams. It was why the spider web was so important, though he wasn't about to get into that with Matthew. The web was to protect him, not involve him. Jordan appeared in the narrow doorway then, and as she joined them, Matthew said, "Was that so hard? We had a conversation. It wasn't just copy pasta."
"What's the conversation?" Jordan asked. "Was it a good one? Was it about me? That would be a good one."
"These guys..." Matthew said. He pointed at an empty frame. Putting her hands on her hips, she studied it as intently as she would if there had still been a painting in it.
"Do you reckon these were sweet metals? Is that what we're thinking?"
Matthew leapt gratefully into the conversation as Declan looked at the two of them. He felt so content in that moment, watching the two of them lightly bat around theories, that it turned right back around into uncertainty. He liked this life so well. He liked the people in it so much, it felt as if the other shoe must drop eventually.
"By the way, you'll never guess who I had a lovely wake-up call from," Jordan told Declan. "Our good friend Boudica came in on the tails of my nudie landlord to let me know that their sweet metals are going fast and they're waiting to hear from me. And also, had I ever thought about getting together a portfolio for a gallery?"
"Bribery is new. What did you tell them?"
I appreciated their diligence, and I was still having a bit of a think if I even really needed one these days. Would they let me know when the last one was on the line?
This was perhaps what Declan liked the best about all of this, about Jordan Hennessy. She could handle herself. He'd never had anyone in his life who didn't need him to manage, guard, chastise, protect. He'd never had an equal. He'd never even known he wanted an equal, and now that she was there, he liked it.
They loved that, of course, Jordan said with her usual grin.
No, that was probably what Declan liked the very best about all of this. Never in his life would anyone have accused Declan Lynch of being an optimist, but he had to admit that he was starting to see the perks. Things might be okay, he thought. Jordan and Matthew were dreams, yes, but as long as Hennessy and Ronan were alive, they could live their own lives. And if something happened to Hennessy or Ronan, now Declan knew that sweet metals existed in the world to wake them up. Even if he couldn't immediately get his hands on one, he no longer had to fear losing his entire remaining family in one go. He had recourse. Things could be okay. Things were okay. He'd never felt that way before. He liked it very, very much. As the three of them pushed out of the museum into the chilly day, his phone rang. He held up a finger to the others to let them know he'd catch up at the car in a minute, and he answered it. Hello? Adam Parrish said, "We really need to talk about Bride." 24. The city woke up, Adam said.
Back that up a moment, Declan replied. Explain to me what that means.
He'd found Adam in line for a celebrity chef's food truck in Harvard Square, an establishment that served gourmet waffles with savory toppings for $14 a pop. Adam introduced the other students waiting with him as his good college friends, but Declan was dubious. The way they all stood together with Adam reminded him a little of a computer wallpaper he'd seen at the school office, a big shepherd dog standing with a bunch of ducklings huddled around its legs. Probably the photo was supposed to be cute, but at the time, Declan had thought about how unrewarding and one-directional the effort must be for the dog. This feeling of Declan's had only been underlined when the friend group discovered the food truck was cash only and began to wail, forcing Adam to patiently count out bills from his wallet in return for waffles and IOUs. Adam had changed since their time together at Aglenby Academy, Declan thought. Old Adam never had any money. And old Adam would have scathingly pointed out the large cash-only sign tacked to the truck rather than come to his wealthy friend's rescue.
I thought Cambridge was dead before this, Adam said, leading Declan briskly through the Harvard campus.
They'd left Adam's ducklings eating in order to speak more privately, and now that he was out of sight of them, Adam ate his fancy waffle on the way, perfunctorily, one bite after another, until it was all gone, without any sign of enjoyment.
No lay energy. That's why Ronan went straight to Nightwash here.
What is it you wanted me to see? Declan asked.
We're not there yet. I don't use it like him, but I can feel the ley line too. I use it if I scry or read cards.
Glancing behind him, Adam led Declan out of Harvard Yard to Oxford Street. There, he slowed his pace, but Declan could not yet see anything unusual. It was all quaint and scenic, red brick, white trim, black trees, blue skies.
I couldn't really do any of that after coming here. Like I said, the city was dead. Those tarot readings you saw were just for show. I was just reading people, parlor tricks, fake magic. But lately I've been feeling these, I don't know, pulses, like power surges or heartbeats.
Declan wasn't sure he liked the sound of the last bit. Power surges sounded clinical and manageable. Heartbeats sounded living. And living things were unpredictable and hard to control.
And then something really happened last night, Adam said. Look here.
They faced a more modern building labeled Science Center. Casting a furtive glance up and down the street, Adam crouched beside a concrete bench built into the wall. Reaching beneath it, he scraped out a large handful of debris. Then he showed it to Declan. To Declan's surprise, it was not leaf litter, but beetles. Some were small, ordinary-looking insects, black and unremarkable. Others were huge and spotted, with the portentous grace of elephants. Some had massive forked antlers. Others were brilliantly blue, with galaxies of stars glittering through the color. Declan did not have to be told they were not native to Cambridge. "These are the Rockefeller beetles, some of them. Do you know what those are? There's 100,000 of them on display in the Museum of Natural History just over there." Adam plucked one from his handful and showed it to Declan. The bullet-shaped beetle was ferociously green. It also had a perfect little hole straight through it when he held it up to the sun. That's where the pin would go to hold it to the mount. "Dreams," Declan said. Adam nodded grimly. "Whatever happened, this pulse, it was strong enough to wake up these dreams. Long enough for them to find a way out of their cases in the museum to get over here. Not long enough to keep them awake." "How did you find out about this?" Adam carefully swept the beetles back under the bench. "I was doing readings, and I got lost in one of the cards when it surged. After I got myself back, I came out looking for where it was coming from, just in time to see them crawling across the road here."